moisturizer. I used to use NARS tinted moisturizer with sunscreen, but they're dead to me now. I've switched to woman-owned, cruelty-free Juice Beauty CC Cream. It smells like a dandelion stem and makes my skin glisten like a beautiful sea snail. Eyeshadow, for regular life. I was using NARS, but again, fuck those dudes. So I switched to Melt. Co-founders Laura Arellano and Dana Bomar look like two women dancing at a St. Vincent concert that you stare at with your mushroomed out eyeballs as a tear falls down your face because you are not friends with them. Eyeshadow, for impressing other women. I was using Stila's Glitter and Glow Liquid Eye Color, owned by Estee Lauder, but now I bedazzle my lids with Anna Petrosian's Dose of Colors. When you go out with sparkly eyelids, women will ask you what eyeshadow you're wearing, and you have to be a good brand ambassador for the cosmetic ladies out there changing the ratio. Spread the good word, Janice Appleseed. Concealer. I was using Becca until I discovered they, too, are owned by Estee Lauder. I need a good concealer because my neighbors fuck really loudly to Portishead, and I'm a light sleeper, which means every morning I wake up with purple circles under my eyes. Coupled with my paper-thin Irish skin, I look like The Walking Dead without concealer. I really like RMS Beauty's Beauty Uncover-Up Concealer. They sell at Sephora, but Sephora is dude-run, so color match there, put your fingers in all the products, swatch your face like a flesh rainbow, steal some register tape, scream, "Fight the patriarchy!" and then go to the RMS site to purchase. Mascara. I used to be dedicated to Laura Mercier's Long Lash Mascara, but then I got pink eye and I was like, fuck spending all this money on mascara, and bought this brand called Prestige, which I've since dumped for Nude Sticks Vegan Mascara. Started by two teenage sisters, this company also makes one-color face sticks for people like me whose personal brand dictates all over, monochromatic. Yes, I made this macrame chandelier myself. Desert author look. Blush. Again, I've owned every single NARS blush. I wish I could say it was joyful to throw them in the trash, knowing they'd be replaced by products I could feel better about. But the only solace I got was knowing a lot of them were 10 years old and filled with pestilent microbial megacities. I switched to Makes Satin Finish Powder Blush in Geisha. It's the perfect utility blush color. Plus, the company gives 10% of its sales to We See Beauty, which then hands the money to women-led, worker-owned businesses, so you get 2 pussy points per purchase. Lipstick. In 2015, Melissa Butler went on Shark Tank to pitch an idea. A natural lipstick that would be worn by every skin color without risking cancer tap dancing on your pie hole. The sharks weren't buying it. Mr. Wonderful called her company, Lip Bar, clown makeup, and said Butler and her crew were colorful cockroaches. I would have poured nail polish remover all over the hood of Mr. Wonderful's Maybach, but class act Melissa turned her time on Shark Tank into a business opportunity. Today, Lip Bar is thriving because women believed in her message, and her website reads like a women's studies class. On the Lip Bar 101 page, she writes, "I am passionate about creating an inclusive narrative on what beauty is and reminding women that we don't have to settle for anything. You are beautiful just the way you are. You don't have to transform to look like the next It Girl. You don't have to do anything but be you, because you are enough." Buy Lip Bar because their colors are amazing and vegan, and it's a nice big fuck you to Kevin O'Leary. Kevin ran for head of the Conservative Party last year in Canada and might run again, so I hope you're ready to see Make Canada Great Again hats. Brow filler. I once used Benefit, which I loved because they hired my first gay friend, Jade, to be a makeup artist at their Foley's counter. Jade is a petite man who moved from Bigot Grove, Texas, to be in Houston, which he thought would be a safer place. At the counter, I saw cowboys spit on him while walking through with their wives, and the store did nothing about it. Benefit has a soft spot in my heart because of their counter-inclusiveness, but they're owned by Louis Vuitton, so now I use Nudestick's Eyebrow Stylus Pencil. Perfume. I'll sometimes wear a shirt that's only staying out of the dirty clothes hamper because it vaguely smells like Le Labo Poivre 23. I figure I'm ripping away thousands of dollars from men across the cosmetics universe, so maybe you can rip my Le Labo out of my cold, dead hands. As a poor kid, I always smelled like dust or old plastic shoes, so I am obsessed with smelling rich even if I haven't taken a shower in 2 days. It took me an entire plane ride from Boston to Los Angeles, 6 whole hours, with the GoGo internet actually functioning the whole time, to figure out which female-owned brands to give my beauty dollars to. When I was done, I felt a really deep sense of accomplishment. Look at me! I found out a way to make myself acceptably beautiful for society while making other women rich. When we were about to land, I was doing my face cleaning, re-moisturizing routine, and my mascara fell out of my makeup bag. The man next to me, who'd been watching old football games on ESPN Classic and smelled like Pringles farts, picked it up, handed it back to me, and said, "Here's your pen." After all my depressing research, if you told me he ran Urban Decay, I would not have been surprised. Chapter 6. Embrace the woman you are, girl. In 2017, millions of people around the world came out to take part in the Women's March. And sure, it was impactful or whatever, but I think it could have been more successful had they dropped the word woman and called it the Girls' March. Everyone knows girls are the new women, and women are the new decrepit, leather-faced, toothless forest witches. Second-wave feminism was lousy with women. In the 70s, there was Bionic Woman, Helen Reddy with I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, and Anjoli, the 8-hour perfume for the 24-hour woman. In full-tilt commercial feminism, the jingle went, I can bring home the bacon, I can fry it up in a pan, and I'll never ever let you forget if you're a man, 'cause I'm a woman. We can't have it all! Work, cook, and fuck? That's what the Bionic Woman should have been about. In the 70s, women were everywhere, bossing around everyone with their adult needs and opinions. It was exhausting taking all these women seriously. Thankfully, the Spice Girls kicked through a cotton candy wall and jumped over pink boa hurdles to save us from all of them. They, along with Gwen Stefani and Beyonce 1.0, gave us 90s girl power, punching the patriarchy in the face while eating ice cream in bright crop tops and brown lipstick. They weren't afraid to kick ass in a short skirt. But girl power wasn't a particularly feasible movement for me as a teenager. As someone who was 5'9 in the third grade, I've looked like a 25-year-old Pottery Barn floor manager since elementary school. I didn't have time to stand up to my oppressors. I was too busy yanking down the girl power baby doll dresses so my vagina wouldn't touch the public school chairs. Girl power fashion requirements didn't come in size extra tall. The movement continued on without me and consumed everything in its path. Girl, it's a girl's world now. Women are just living in it. What kind of girl are you, woman? It girl? Daddy's girl? Manic pixie dream girl? Holla back girl? Party girl? Working girl? Gossip girl? Mean girl? Catch me outside, how about that girl? Maybe you're the kind of girl who wants to define what kind of girl she's grown up to be. Look at what a powerful movement Bethany Frankel created as a skinny girl. Skinny Girl Margarita is the perfect cocktail for an innocent, carefree flirt. Doesn't that sound better than Skinny Woman Margarita? Perfect for an alcoholic in a stained nightshirt, binging Blue Bloods at 3 p.m. on a Wednesday. There's no shortage of girls to watch on TV. Two Broke Girls, Gilmore Girls, HBO Girls, and New Girl, which is about a quirky girl in her 30s. A show called New Woman would be about a divorcee going to the dermatologist's office for a sobering talk about eczema. When women go out, it's a girls' night out. The last girls' night out I had was with high school friends in Houston. We got tanked at a Vietnamese restaurant. Well, all of us except for Gretchen, who's been sober since she landed in jail twice for drunk driving. 3 hours later, we were at Numbers, drinking well vodka and dancing to a Joy Division-heavy soundtrack. I got high in the bathroom with Carrie, who showed me her tummy tuck scar. So yeah, there's basically zero difference between that and a 4-year-old girl's Dora the Explorer-themed birthday party. It's relaxing to be a girl, because no one's trying to stomp on a girl's right to choose, because the choice is nearly always strawberry. Girls don't have to be taken seriously, and when a girl accomplishes something, it's more cute than impressive. Like, all a girl graduating with a PhD in social work had to do was stand in front of a millennial pink wall making a peace sign. Girls need protection and guidance. Women need Botox and Spanx. But girl, can we talk about girls in books? Girls totally rule in books! Books with girl in the title have been number one New York Times bestsellers for 4 out of the past 6 years. You know what books I'm talking about, girl. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Girl on the Train, Gone Girl, The Girls, Some Girls, Razor Girl, The Good Girl, Girl in the Dark, Girls on Fire, Girl at War, Luckiest Girl Alive, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, How to Build a Girl, and A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. One girl book explodes onto the scene and everyone wants to capture that magic. The magic being that a girl character raises the stakes. A dead girl has lost all her potential. A dead woman just loses her extensions. But according to 538, the girl mentioned in the title of the book is much more likely to be a woman. Titles featuring the word girl have spiked since the 90s. And especially since 2012 when Gone Girl debuted. And a full 2/3 of these innocent babes are actually full-on ladies. Sneaky bastards. The website also found if the title was written by a dude, the girl was more likely to end up dead. Robert Durst, if you're listening to this right now, stop masturbating! Female authors are more likely to write books with girl in the title, although it's slightly unfair to put the blame on them because the title of a book is often a compromise between publisher and author. For example, I wanted to call this book, You're the Girl Now, Dog! But they said the title wasn't good and to return my advance. My publisher is missing out on millions of dollars because some exhausted AccuView rep isn't picking up this book at a Denver International bookstore because it doesn't have the word girl in the title! When girl books hit pay dirt, Hollywood comes a-knockin', wanting to cash in on some of that sweet, sweet girl money. If I set foot in a movie theater for a girl-titled movie, and the main character is a female in a tuckable turtleneck, I'm asking to see the manager. Ma'am, are you aware the girl in this movie is a 45-year-old divorcee with visible gray roots? I'll take my $16 back, please, plus parking. But I'm happy to pay for the Sour Patch Kids. At least they were as young as advertised. It's not culturally acceptable to call a grown man boy, unless you're already BFFs. I've never called my doctor up and said, hey boy, what do my blood panels say? There's only one exception of a boy label men would accept proudly. Bad boy. You know the kind of guy straight women slash gay men are not supposed to want but just gotta have. A leather-clad motorcycle boy who ignores your no-shoes rule and wears his dirty fry boots all over your vintage rug. This boy knows what you want and he's gonna give it to you. Bad boys are so bad. Michael Bay was like, sign me up! I need the hottest bad boys. Ring, ring! Hi, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. This is... I just pulled a bunch of random pieces of paper out of my Dodgers cap and put them together on my marble coffee table. You know, the way I write all my movies. How does starring in a movie about guns, explosions, heroin, and badass detectives called Bad Boys sound? Can we make 3 of them? Doi! The label bad boy elicits power and independence. Drop the bad and it becomes less appealing to many men. Foghorn, leghorn, southern racists use boy to demean. These cartoon antebellum torch carriers use the word to quickly assert the dominant position, and you best not disrespect them the same way. In 2012, I was doing this experiment where I would call anyone, regardless of gender, girl. Most people in LA loved it, probably because I sold it with a tone of, we don't know each other, but I like you. Also, most people in LA would be happy if you called them prepubescent because it confirms their skincare routine is working. Then I went to the Democratic National Convention in Bathroom Bill Ground Zero, North Carolina. It was raining, but security wasn't letting people take their umbrellas inside. Yes, even the DNC is on to the Penguins' revenge capers. I set down my travel umbrella, which I'd owned for 6 years and was part of my family due to my unhealthy attachment to inanimate objects. Then I went inside where a bunch of politicians were preaching to the choir. I also offered Jared Leto a cookie that he did not take. It's not at all important to the story, but it's important that you know that Jared Leto will ignore your chocolate chip cookie offer even if you're in the VIP box as a guest and repeatedly assure him you're not a crasher. I want him to know I was being sincere and I will never, ever forgive him. After the event, I realized thousands of people had also left their umbrellas in my spot, all of whom were in a hurry to get drunk ASAP, and I sure as hell wasn't going to let my precious parasol get lost in the stampede. A stout Michael Chiklis adjacent police officer must have thought it was adorable that a grown woman in a dress would dig through a garbage pile of wet umbrellas, and so he offered to help me look for my little baby. 5 minutes later, I shoved my rain protector in his face and said, "Girl, I found it!" His face turned so red, I thought cartoon steam was going to shoot out of his ears. He was trying to keep his calm, but he was barely hanging on. "What'd you call me?" The police down south like to lock you up for looking at him wrong, and I had just done the language equivalent of reaching for his gun. He didn't have a reason to take me to jail, but southern cops don't need a reason. I smiled at him and I said, "I called you girl. What's wrong with being called girl?" He bored a hole through my head with his cop eyes, and I ran away before he could arrest me for sassing him twice. Maybe I ran away too fast. Is it possible he wasn't mad I called him girl, but mad that I called any adult girl? Maybe he wanted to sit me down and tell me, "No woman should stand for that kind of treatment." But I doubt it. I'm pretty sure his idea of woke is pounding a cup of coffee to rev up his morning. If he were a woman, I'd understand why he'd take offense. Calling a 29-year-old woman girl might seem like a compliment, but it's wrapped in a smallpox blanket of insults. It paints us as childish and makes our opinions easier to dismiss because inside we're just a 6-year-old missing our front teeth with undiagnosable chronic nosebleeds. Calling a woman girl takes away everything we've worked for as adults, like our 401k and the $600 in it, which wasn't easy to do over the course of 10 years. Corporations never got this memo, apparently. They believe girls are more symbolically powerful than women, which is why they rely on them when they're trying to make social statements. On March 8, 2017, a bronze statue of a young woman appeared in front of the Wall Street Bull. Fearless Girl was commissioned by an investment company called State Street Global Advisors. The statue's placard reads, "Know the power of woman and leadership. She makes a difference." She is capitalized because it's a reference to a gender-diverse fund run by State Street Global Advisors, so people who care about diverse boards can invest in those companies. The best way I can describe it is if NASCAR races were 199 laps of vertebrae-fracturing crashes and one lap of white wine drinking and discussion of the book The Piano Teacher. With the statue, State Street got to shout to the world, "Hey, there aren't enough women on company boards!" The company itself has been putting heavy pressure on the businesses they boss around to diversify their ladyless corporate boards. That's a Herculean effort considering Wall Street men seem to respond to directives with a shrug and a smarmy laugh. State Street took bold action. They voted down directors on boards they controlled that did not have women. Yes, Mama! Drag that skeleton man out of the boardroom as he's clinging onto the gold-plated casters on his antique brown leather office chair. But as direct as they've been in exerting pressure on a business level, when it came to their corporate street art, they wanted something softer. State Street Global's CEO, Ron O'Hanley, told The Atlantic, "With the statue, we were very focused on wanting to send the right message. The artist, Kristen Visbowl, was terrific in trying to understand what this commission was really about. Early renditions had a more confrontational pose. But the point was not you versus me." The artist herself echoed the non-threatening tone the statue was meant to evoke. She told press this about Fearless Girl. "She's proud, but not confrontational." I don't know what's not confrontational about Fearless Girl. Created in the image of a preteen girl, she's a 4-foot, 250-pound statue, power stancing, legs sturdy and wide, fists on her hips, poker face, standing strong against the wind and Wall Street's charging bull. She looks like off-duty Chloe Grace Moretz in Kick-Ass. Like at any moment she'd grab a double-sided katana and cut you in half while blowing a bubble. The only thing not confrontational about her is she doesn't have secondary sex characteristics. Had State Street Global surprised the city with a bronze statue of a 34-year-old woman in the same pose, she would have looked like a dick-stomping feminist demanding the bull work on his rage issues. Elizabeth Warren posed by Fearless Girl and tweeted a photo with the caption, "Fight like a girl." I get the symbolic gesture here. Boys insult each other by saying, "You fight like a girl," and we're saying there's nothing wrong with fighting like a girl. But there is. I don't want to fight like a girl, and I don't want to fight like a boy. Children are weak. Have you ever been punched by a 9-year-old? It's like getting jabbed with a raw chicken wing. It's not intimidating. I want to fight like Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2. I want to flip my psych ward bed on its side and do 1 million pull-ups until my muscles are so bulging, Madonna puts a picture of me on her fridge for hashtag Fitspo. I get why people like the idea of girlhood. Girls twirl in lavender fields and have their whole lives ahead of them. That's more fun to think about than a damaged adult hobbling joylessly toward death. But women don't need a million reminders that our youth is the only currency we have in this world. And unless you and I are close enough that you've seen me naked in the Bloomingdale's dressing room, you don't get to call me girl. I'm a woman who never misses a car payment, makes her own chicken stock, raises a beautiful, very reactive, somewhat territorial terrier mix, drinks rosé over $20, and gives her husband blowjobs while wearing an Invisalign retainer. Because that's what a woman does. Chapter 7. Putting the STEM back in feminist STEM. Allow me to ruin a national hero for you. John Glenn was an asshole. In case you missed it, he was the first American to orbit Earth. But that's not why he's a flesh bag full of giraffe turds. John Glenn is a cum basket because in 1962, he actively campaigned Congress to prohibit women from going into space. He took time out of his busy space career farting into spacesuits and not dealing with his T-zone issues to stop Jerry Cobb, Aerospace's Sandra Day O'Connor, from sharing in his galactic glory. Jerry was a female pilot and one of the Mercury 13. A group of 13 women tested by the privately funded Lovelace Foundation's Women in Space program. They underwent all the same testing as the Mercury 7, and in some cases, scored better than the men. Jerry petitioned the House Committee on Science and Astronautics to let her go. But John Glenn had a strict, "no bitches in space" rule. He told the panel, "The men go off and fight the wars and fly the airplanes and come back and help design and build and test them. The fact that women are not in this field is a fact of our social order." Wow! John Glenn is so sexist, he makes Jerry Lewis look like Betty Friedan. His favorite justification for barring women from space was NASA's rule requiring astronauts to be jet pilots, a career women weren't allowed to pursue until 1976. But joke's on America. John Glenn didn't care about NASA's rules. If he did, he wouldn't have allowed himself to be an astronaut because he hadn't earned the science degree required by NASA to be one. John Glenn only had one rule for going into space. Have a prostate. In 1963, a year after American hero John Glenn curb-stomped women's dreams of going into space, Russia announced it was hashtag time's up on space sexism and sent their first woman into orbit, cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova. NASA responded to this historic moment by dismissing her voyage, longer than all of the time collectively spent in space by American astronauts, as a stunt. No, a stunt is riding a BMX bike up a tree. Valentina Tereshkova wasn't trying to get a sick sponsorship from Mountain Dew. She was orbiting goddamn Earth. Finally, in 1983, 11 years after the crimping iron was invented, America got around to sending their first woman into space. Sally Ride made American herstory, but not before a rocket booster full of sexist bullshit was fired directly into her face. While prepping for her mission, NASA asked her if 100 tampons would be enough for her 7-day mission. 100 tampons! If 100 tampons isn't enough, someone get Sally Ride to the emergency room because she is dying! The battle for equality at NASA has been tough, but strides have been made. Half of the graduating class in 2016 were female astronauts, but they might be the last. Self-contained human centipede Donald Trump plans to cut NASA's education wing entirely, which has historically sparked the inner science and engineering nerds in young girls. Before this NASA program, the only way to inspire women to pursue STEM careers, science, technology, engineering, and math, was to watch Dr. Dana Scully fight off an inside-out skin man with a defibrillator on The X-Files. This is a real thing, and it's called the Scully Effect. The Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media interviewed women in STEM and found 2/3 of them saw Gillian Anderson's character as a major role model. I get it. Dana Scully is the reason I chopped off my long hair, dyed it red, and committed to a sensible neutral palette of sleeveless turtlenecks my freshman year of college. But with the FBI forensic pathologist who carries extraterrestrial DNA leaving the X-Files reboot in 2018, and Trump's axing of NASA's education budget, how will we ever fix the gender imbalance in STEM? According to Catalyst, only 24% of STEM jobs are held by women. That's the same percentage of people who enjoyed Speed 2 cruise control. When you get granular, the percentages dip real low. According to the National Science Foundation, women make up only 7.9% of mechanical engineers and 11.1% of physicists. There's an argument that women aren't interested in these careers, to which I say, horse diarrhea. Of course women are interested in STEM careers. We're interested in everything. Some women love these things so much, they're willing to climb over a ton of barriers to pursue them. In 2015, two female researchers decided to look into how gender affects the ability of PhDs to find postdoc jobs in life sciences. Dr. Fiona Ingleby and Megan Head talked to 244 people with biology PhDs and concluded that, surprise, there's a lot of gender bias in academia. So they wrote a manuscript about it and submitted it to PLOS One, an online science resource, and Spellcheck Heart Attack. The way it works in science journals is, in order for your article to be printed, it has to be approved by other people in your field. If those strangers don't think your shit is quality, they send it back to you with notes on how to do it better, dummy. Then you fix your mistakes and resubmit it for consideration. Ingleby and Head weren't published because their anonymous peer reviewer had a problem with the way they interpreted their data. Anonymous peer, whose gender we don't know, but we can guess, took issue with the wild conclusion that women biologists were treated unfairly, even though their research showed female doctoral candidates co-authored fewer papers. Anonymous peer hypothesized women co-authored fewer papers because male doctoral candidates were able to work 15 minutes longer per week, according to some study he did not reference, but did chalk up to marginal gender differences of physiology and health. If we're just throwing what-ifs around, let's say men can work for an extra 15 minutes. Maybe their hands are more nimble and fresh because they're not exhausting them folding clean laundry till 11 p.m. Anonymous peer also suggested male doctoral students can probably run a mile race a bit faster than female doctoral students. Huh? Is there some Newtonian law I don't know about correlating paper writing and running? Anonymous peer suggested a way to fix the manuscript would be for the women to find one or two male biologists to co-author and help them strengthen it. What are they supposed to do with that criticism? Douse their work with Axe body spray and send it back in for reassessment? Or maybe, anonymous peer, you just proved their point. Sexism in science can be so pervasive, it infects female academics. Dr. Alice Wong is a 78-year-old female molecular biologist who writes an advice column for the journal Science. In 2015, she received a letter from a postdoc whose advisor, she said, had a habit of looking down her shirt during meetings. Here's Dr. Huang's advice. Some definitions of sexual harassment do include inappropriate looking or staring, especially when it's repeated to the point where the workplace becomes inhospitable. Has it reached that point? I don't mean to suggest that leering is appropriate workplace behavior. It isn't. But it is human, and up to a point, I think, forgivable. That's great news for me! If acting on your human impulses is forgivable, I'm gonna start shitting wherever I want. I'm gonna go right into Chico's, and when the saleswoman asks if she can help me, I'll respond, I'm here for a chunky necklace, but first, nature calls! And then I'm gonna squat down on their faux marble floors and go to town. And when the security guard tries to drag me out, I'll scream, it's human and forgivable! Dr. Huang went on to tell this woman, who is dealing with a very unprofessional situation, as long as your advisor does not move on to other advances, I suggest you put up with it, with good humor if you can. Here's how you can handle it with humor. Next time a man is looking at your tits, try this. Look him in the eyes, giggle lightly and say, it's so funny that you're trying to look at my boobs. Now that you've got everyone's attention, escalate your laugh into a deep, maniacal cackle. He'll try to leave the area, but you block him with your last scream and shout, it's so funny that you're trying to see my titties, because you're never going to see them. Never. And then keep laughing until no one knows what to do, so they pack up their things and leave the building out of fear for their own safety. It's easy to villainize Dr. Wong, but when you look at her work, not only in science, but also her work toward the inclusion, development, and advancement of women in careers in microbiology, it makes you wonder what kind of bullshit she's been dealing with for the last 51 years. Women pursuing the careers of their dreams develop special rules to deal with the hostility around them, either because they think no one will do anything about the bad behavior, they usually don't, or because they don't have the energy to fight it. There are so many things to fight, and people. Like ex-University of Arizona astronomy professor Timothy Frederick Slater, who openly commented on women's bodies, went to strip clubs, and gave a student a vibrator shaped like a cucumber. Outside of being extremely inappropriate, it's a terribly cartoonish view of female sexual habits. I don't know any woman who has blasted salad ingredients up her vagina. We're not living in pioneer times where women masturbate with whatever bounty Mother Nature has provided for us. Maybe the butt end of a sonicare or a heavy pressure hand shower, but not a cucumber. Never a cucumber. And none of this was made public for over a decade until Timothy, a pickle for your vagina, Slater, was outed on the floor of Congress by Representative Jackie Speier. In the meantime, he moved from the University of Arizona to the University of Wyoming, where I bet no one knew his reputation for being an inappropriate dick snot. Shuffling these male offenders from university to university accomplishes nothing. These guys need to learn. Maybe they can figure out a place to get some helpful information at the massive educational facilities they work at. Where's the mandatory how to not harass the females around you class these guys are required to take so they can be aware of their behavior and why it's unacceptable? What happens when universities take the side of the harasser? Jeff Marcy, the world-renowned astronomer at UC Berkeley, sexually harassed so many women, female postdocs refused to apply for faculty positions at the college because they didn't want to deal with his unwanted kissing, massaging, or worse, him grabbing their vaginas under tables at professional dinners. Despite the accusations of many women, UC Berkeley chose not to fire him. But because of the outrage online, Marcy resigned, issuing a perfect non-pology. Non-pology is a made-up word I use to describe a fake apology that acknowledges the reaction to the wrongdoing while avoiding blame for doing the bad thing in the first place. Here's Marcy's to illustrate. While I do not agree with each complaint that was made, it is clear that my behavior was unwelcome by some women. It is difficult to express how painful it is for me to realize I was a source of distress for any of my women colleagues, however unintentional. In other words, I'm sorry about your reaction to an innocent mistake outside my control. I have a hypothesis for male scientists that I think will help them understand. If a woman is offended by your words, then you are saying something repugnant. When you hear about the next guy, you're going to wonder why we let these dudes near explosive lab equipment. Tim Hunt, a Nobel laureate biochemist from the redundantly named University College London, was speaking at the World Conference of Science Journalists in South Korea, specifically addressing a convention of senior female scientists and science journalists. And here's what he said to an audience of women. Let me tell you the trouble with girls. Three things happen when they're in the lab. You fall in love with them. They fall in love with you. And when you criticize them, they cry. Way to know your audience, Tim. Follow it up with your tight five on Korean comfort women. After his speech, Tim flew home, trudged up to his office, pulled out a skeleton key, or whatever British people unlock doors with, and packed up all his stuff because he was forced to resign. For anyone who feels like these guys shouldn't lose their jobs or step down, take that sympathy, box it up, wrap it, put a bow on it, and hand it over to the women who were pussy shoved out of their science careers. Or fired for just being a woman who dared to exist in the company of men. Scientists starting their careers depend exclusively on the favor of faculty members above them for everything. If you have a serial harasser who's the only person with the power to give you access to research funding, and you know your college won't do anything about his advances, it doesn't take a scientist to deduce the two possible outcomes are dreadful and horrible. The Center for Talent Innovation, an advocacy group focused on diversifying the workforce, did a study on STEM careers with cry-worthy results. When the report asked senior STEM leaders, both men and women, if they thought a woman would be able to reach top jobs at their organization, a third of them plainly said, no. As if that weren't terrible enough, women are paid $58,000 compared to men with the same degrees who are bringing home $85,000. Which is weirdly like someone in the payroll department going, how can we streamline our gender pay gap? I know, we'll just switch around the first two numbers. And if you're a black or Hispanic woman, the science world could at least pat you on the head and say, oh, it's so sweet you think you can do this. Bless your heart. That would be nicer than how these fields currently treat these women. In a study by UC Hastings, 100% of the women of color reported gender bias. All of them. There wasn't one woman of color in science in this study who reported that her career was smooth sailing. You'll always have to prove yourself, to show skill. I've never, ever had anything easy, one black biochemist told UC Hastings. Latinas, meanwhile, were more likely to be asked by male colleagues to do admin work, like organizing meetings and filling out forms. According to the female-authored study, Double Jeopardy, a study so discouraging and sad, they were practically forced to name it after the lackluster 1999 Ashley Judd thriller. Nearly half of the black and Latina scientists said they were regularly mistaken as janitors. A statistician in the report said, at first, she chalked it up to her being at the lab at weird hours. She said, they assume that I'm the janitor, okay? I always amuse my friends with my janitor stories. But it has happened, not only at weird hours. Look, there is no shame in being a janitor. Some of the nicest alcoholics I know are janitors. But can you imagine going to school for 700 years, getting your dream job, and while you're at work splicing those jeans, someone taps you on the shoulder and says, we're out of toilet paper in the shitter, and Jason's been eating a lot of Chobani, even though he's lactose intolerant, so it's rough in there. It's rude and sexist, but also so stupid. Fixing this problem will require a veritable fuck ton of work, but it'll pay off in spades. We need STEM journalists, STEM faculty, STEM mentors to make these fields safe for women to learn and thrive. We need more STEM women in positions of power. And if you are a university, use this rule from the Carl Sagan's Baloney Detection Kit, a practical guide for dealing with bullshit. It's one of my favorite rules and the one I think every institution should use when considering the excuses of men in positions of power. Arguments from authority carry little weight. Authorities have made mistakes in the past. They will do so again in the future. Wise words from a smart man who rocked a rust-colored turtleneck like nobody else. In the vein of being objective and rational, you know, two basic scientific principles, we need all of the brains on the science jobs. Building floating bridges, curing diseases, inventing 4D printing, solving the singularity, destroying Facebook, designing driverless cars that don't murder. All of it! There's a reason I'm so passionate about having more women in STEM. Number one, it's fair and just and all that stuff. Number two, and this is very personal, I need women on the job of figuring out proper dosages for pot brownies, which are wildly inconsistent. This is very serious. Figuring this out is the difference between me being at the airport, underneath a seat, crushed by the idea of infinite space, and me joyfully dancing to Bitch Better Have My Money, chomping on some Shake Shack. So get your shit together, STEM, and let those women in. My travel experience depends on it. Chapter 8. The NFL does not care about your breast cancer. If poor Irish families had coats of arms, ours would look like this. A griffin drunk on Jameson. A lion giving a fawn an Ogilvy home perm. A dragon cheating at Boulder Dash. And a wild boar riddled with breast cancer in all eight of its teats. What my family lacks in natural talents, we more than make up for in our ability to get breast cancer. Two aunts and a grandmother, all taken from us by the deadly tumors. My mom, two more of her sisters, and a cousin all successfully warded off breast cancer with chemotherapy. The rest of the women in the family wait for it to choose one of us. Who will be next? Breast cancer is scary. Not to say all cancers aren't scary. They are. But breast cancer has an added fear factor. The constant reminders of its existence. Remember the last time a trip to Target didn't involve walking past breast cancer awareness pink ribbon flip-flops, coloring books, batteries, spatulas, shower curtains, or dog bones? I don't. Target to me is just a bunch of breast cancer awareness products and a drapery aisle where all the panel curtains are only available in singles. Sorry about your wide living room window, Neely. Looks like your neighbor will be keeping her front row view of your Saturday Frasier binge sessions. It's one thing to see a breast cancer awareness shaving cream next to your razor refills. It's another one to see it and be reminded of the thing that murdered your sweet fucking grandma. But Erin, my mom says after she's given me a breast cancer awareness umbrella, think about the lives this plastic garbage from China saved. I don't know, Mom, but lung cancer is the number one cancer killer among women, and I don't see anyone wearing a Save the Airbags t-shirt during lungs or sexy fun runs. I tell her hours later when I have the energy to rehash the conversation in my own terms in a bathtub after Googling cancer sets. Why does breast cancer get to hog all the awareness? I've heard a rumor that everyone loves boobs, but the obsession with jugs can't fuel the awareness machine entirely. I know plenty of guys who love big, beautiful butts, but I'd be hard-pressed to find someone passionate about curing ass cancer. Breast cancer awareness is the invention of one of the largest manufacturers of the breast cancer drugs Arimidex, Imfinzi, Zoladex, Calquence, Aressa, Cosidex, Lynparza, Falsidex, Tagrisso, and Nolbion. Just kidding, the last one I made up. What a ridiculous name for a serious drug. National Breast Cancer Awareness Month is now a legacy program of the AstraZeneca Healthcare Foundation. Reads the description of the website run by the Cancer Drug King. Side note, do you think AstraZeneca is a beautiful name for a daughter conceived in the EDM tent at Coachella? According to their website, www.beautifulcancerfreetits.org, just kidding, it's their name.com, they made $6.9 billion of core operating profit in 2017. That's enough money to light cigars with flaming $1,000 bills, if that's a thing that even exists. I'm not a money expert, okay? As far as I'm concerned, the $50 U.S. savings bond I won in fifth grade will pay for my retirement. And I only Google information allowing me to win arguments with my mom, so I guess we'll never know if $1,000 bills are a thing. Call me a cynic, but the idea of a company profiting off breast cancer, then starting a charity to draw attention to breast cancer, seems suspect. Imagine if Walter White had started a meth addiction awareness campaign to help people find out if they love meth. To me, breast cancer awareness is a money hustle for drug companies, and the hustle is catching on. Breast Cancer Awareness Month used to just be October, a time to remind women to lay those boobs in between two below-freezing metal plates and let the machine that crushes old cars into neat little squares go to town on them. Personally, I'd rather be repeatedly punched in the tit than have a mammogram. During the procedure, I found it unbelievable that my breast tissue wasn't shooting out of my nipple. I had my first mammogram at 28 because of my family history of breast cancer, and you better believe I hated every minute of this very important life-saving breast cancer screening. But breast cancer awareness, like cancer, has spread to other months. And it's not just about cancer screenings, it's about shopping! Sunglasses and lip balm and scarves and KFC chicken and candles and water bottles. Any product can be affiliated with breast cancer awareness. Take the NFL. Their approach to breast cancer awareness integration is like a fanatical mother planning her only daughter's first wedding. They slap Pantone 218 pink on everything. Shoes, sweatbands, shirts, penalty flags. Thank you, sports group who can't seem to curb domestic abuse by the hands of your own players and grossly underpaid cheerleaders. You do care about women! The other cool thing about the NFL's fundraising efforts is they're accountable to no one. While the LA Rams' new era Heather Gray breast cancer awareness sideline hat will set you back $25.99, only a sliver will actually make it to charity. According to Julie DeCaro at Sports Illustrated, which I read for the very first time just to bring you this, only $12.50 of every $100 of pink merchandise goes to the American Cancer Society Change Program, also known as the ACS. This program awards grants to community-based health facilities located within 100 miles of an NFL city to educate women about breast health. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Awareness, which I've now made you aware of, making it Breast Cancer Awareness Awareness Awareness. Change said they answered 72,000 women's questions about early detection of breast cancer. Wow! That's probably 1 trillionth of the times Google has answered the same questions. They also bragged about screening 10,000 women at little or no cost. Little cost? Shouldn't it be fucking free? Here's what they do, explained in this delicious word salad on their website. Change grants serve as a catalyst for partners to implement and sustain interventions, to effectively engage and mobilize patients, and implement systems and policies that are essential to increasing access to timely cancer screenings. Women in underserved communities don't need a lesson in breast exams, a pamphlet, and a pat on the back. They need practical help that the American Cancer Society and the NFL are not providing. If breast cancer awareness were an actual philanthropic endeavor, 100% of the fundraising would go towards research to find a cure. Good luck with drug companies making cigar lighting profits and helping women who have breast cancer. The Pink Fund, a nonprofit providing financial assistance to women undergoing breast cancer treatment, conducted a study in 2017 and found that 41% of women skipped medication or treatment because of financial obstacles, and 37% are in debt after treatment. This shit makes me so mad, I want to kick my clog booties through the wall. But I own my home, and it took me a really long time to find a pair of Dutch-inspired footwear that didn't make me look like I'm wearing Optimus Prime Transformer feet, so I'll settle for screaming into a drool-stained pillow. There's absolutely no reason any woman should go into debt to stay alive when there is plenty of breast cancer money floating around to help them. Time for some math! Get out your calculators and your graph paper and your eraser and your ruler and your protractor and your gin. Here's your SAT question. If the National Cancer Institute says they spent $519 million on breast cancer research, along with the National Institutes of Health, which spent $656 million, and in Leah Goldman's Marie Claire article, The Big Business of Breast Cancer, she estimates $6 billion a year is raised by breast cancer awareness programs, how much money is breast cancer making? Take your time. My iPhone started doing this E9 shit, so I had to do the math the old-fashioned way, with a barely working mechanical pencil on the back of a laser hair removal pamphlet. Did you get it? That's right! It's a whopping $7,175,000,000! Okay, so let's set the average cost of chemotherapy to treat breast cancer at $30,000. And there are, on average, 230,000 women diagnosed yearly in the United States, which makes the cost of treating all the women with breast cancer diagnoses $6,900,000,000, leaving a whopping $275 million for research. That's the real breast cancer awareness. Are you aware of how many women could be helped right now, today, this second, who aren't because it's all getting dumped into research and making shitty pink mouse pads? Or maybe it's getting straight up wasted. One scummy organization, the Breast Cancer Society, was embroiled in a massive charity fraud case reported on by Rebecca R. Ruiz in the New York Times, where the people running the group and three other cancer charities spent donations on being extra in so many ways, but specifically eating at Hooters and shopping sprees at Victoria's Secret. Oh my God! What hilarious trash! Misappropriating breast cancer donations to buy things at boob places? Garbage! There are antebellum elevators I trust more than some of the charities associated with breast cancer. But breast cancer sleazes shouldn't deter you from doing everything you can to stay on top of your personal breast health. First of all, get acquainted with your boobs and do a monthly self-exam. Maybe time it after an evening spent watching Tom Hardy in Warrior, or an hour lost on Michael B. Jordan's shirtless Instagram selfies. What I'm saying is have fun with it! According to a study published by the American Medical Association, having 10 or more drinks a day can increase your risk, so don't work at a winery. Get those knockers squished, and if you think anything is wrong, demand to have the issue dealt with. If you're me, and wonderful women you love have died from breast cancer, get genetic testing. When the test for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene came out, my mom begged Audrey and me to do it. The genes produce tumor suppressor proteins, and if these genes have a mutation on them, it gives you a 70% lifetime likelihood for getting boob cancer. The older you get, the higher your chances. Wish that was the rule for acting roles, right, ladies? Hashtag Hollywood joke. But those stats didn't scare me. I was 28, and I had better things to worry about, like, can I pull off skinny scarves? Turns out the answer is no. Paired with a tank top, they make me look like the Pirates of the Caribbean's accounts payable department. To pacify my justifiably frightened mother, I got a mammogram, referenced before, boobs turned into papyrus by the cold metal hands of a robot. Turns out I have dense breasts, way up on every guy's list, right up there with vascular butt. Dense breasts are hard to monitor, so I was off to my first breast MRI. They found nothing, but one of the technicians told me I'd probably have to do these screenings every year. My mom and her sisters spent their 30s getting lumpectomies, where a doctor opens your breast up like a toaster oven and fishes out suspicious bumps, and so here I was, staring down the same road. It's not how I planned to spend my 30s. What about the time machine I wanted to build to travel back to 1996 and marry Trainspotting era Ewan McGregor? Audrey's results came back negative. She called to tell me the good news and asked me when I was getting the test done. I wasn't. I was very busy with 11 p.m. Tuesday night improv rehearsals for my comedy group Panties in a Bunch. Why couldn't everyone see how swamped I was? Then I got a call from her later that week. She was discussing my personal testing decisions with her genetic counselor, and he said, "If you knew your sister was about to jump off a bridge, wouldn't you save her?" Who knew Houston genetic counselors were such drama whores? Take that scene-stealing energy to the Alley Theater, right, Houston? Hashtag Houston jokes. The next week, I was tested through the Gilda Radner program at Cedars in Los Angeles. They called with the news a couple of weeks later. I was carrying a genetic time bomb! I started looking into my options for a double mastectomy. I saw a male oncologist who told me not to do it. Despite all the women with breast cancer he'd seen die, he didn't see why I should have to have such a radical surgery at such a young age. I asked him if he'd ever seen a 29-year-old die of breast cancer, and he replied, "Yes, many." Okay, so he's seen women die at my age, but I shouldn't have the surgery because of some reason he wants to stay mysterious about? I didn't have a particular attachment to my teeny girls, Louisa May Alcott and Amelia Earhart. I was an A on a bloated day. I understand it must be harder for women with perfect tits to chop them off, but nothing is as important as being alive. And getting rid of your boobs does you a service. It's hard for the worst guys, who are great at pretending they're the best guy, to hide their disappointment when hearing the words double mastectomy. Any man whose jaw drops and color disappears from his cheeks doesn't deserve the pleasure of seeing you naked. My terrible gynecologist, who I will talk about more in a later chapter, tried to talk me out of the double mastectomy because how would I breastfeed? To which I replied, "Not very easily if I'm dead." In his eyes, boobs greater than women. Despite all these doctors who were spewing bad advice about my corrupted chest, I cut them off anyway because I found out I could get bigger ones. Yeah, that's right. I had a preventative mastectomy for bigger boobs. If I'm going to go through a bunch of surgery, there better be a fucking prize at the end. Double mastectomies are not easy. They remove my breast tissue and auxiliary lymph nodes to be sure anything that might get cancer was gone. Then they threw my tainted body parts in the trash, I guess. I don't know what they do with them. Do they throw them in the garbage? Like, does some raccoon dive into a dumpster looking for 4-day-old spaghetti only to find someone's useless discarded knee is on the menu? What I do know is some of my body trash went to a research program. And if I ever find out my cells are in some Henrietta Lacks situation where they're